Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and start. Daydreaming Danielle. I almost thought I'd ask to see if anyone here was named Danielle. Do you struggle with daydreaming problems? I think that everyone in the board and whoever was making up titles was just trying to be creative. Did any of you notice the disturbing title with Larry in it? Wasn't that awful? Why did they do that? I came sneaking by that other room and Wendell said, "Larry, you should have been teaching this class." I said, "No, I should be in that class." So anyway, daydreaming Danielle. Daydreaming is probably something that all teachers, no matter how many, even if you only have one student, you're going to face problems with daydreamers. Daydreamers come in lots of different ways. Some of them are chronic, happens daily. Some of them, it's just kind of a random thing. Friday was their bad day, and so they just daydreamed all day. Had a stack of homework. But daydreaming is actually a problem that you, even adults, never get away from. How many of you as a teacher found yourself after school where there's a stack of work beside you, but you were just daydreaming? How many of you? Oh, good. Because it's actually kind of fun. Daydreaming can transport you to another place. You can think about anything. Dreaming is free and it's fun. And you can dream about things that you'll never do. Don't ever get stuck on Wikipedia just dreaming about science projects and future math classes. And if you're like me, devotional ideas. They just pop out from everywhere. Wikipedia is a dangerous place to go if you're in the mood for daydreaming. I'm going to read you a little story to start class off. How many of you have ever read the book Tom Sawyer? How many of you have started the book of Tom Sawyer but thought it was boring and never finished it? Okay. How many of you know who wrote the book Tom Sawyer? Okay, someone say it.
Mark Twain.
Good. Mark Twain had this little saying. He said, "You know what?" Someone walked into his house and they saw books just everywhere. Books, 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 books. And they said, "Mark Twain, don't you think you have lots of books?" "Yeah," he said, "I do have lots of books." There wasn't even enough shelves for them. And he said, "You know, books are so much fun. Friends give you books. You have books. It's just, books are fun." But he said, "You know what? The hard part about books is it's hard to find friends that will loan you shelves for them." And I think that's actually probably a quote that I will remember for the rest of my life is, I love books, but after you get but so many of them, they don't have a home anymore, and they actually start to be clutter. And you know that somewhere in that whole stack you have a book that's juicy and fun, but if you can't access it, then it's lost to you. So Mark Twain obviously understood the dilemma. Ken, if you don't mind, just, I don't know who, I'll raise your hand if you need a song when he gets close to you, and you can get one from him, and we'll just keep on having class. Even though he's going, I'm going to move this over a bit. It feels like it's kind of in our way. All right. We'll start off with this story. This story is taken out of the big book of Tom Sawyer and his lots of famous escapades. And this story is about Tom Sawyer and his activities of painting a fence. Those of you that read it will know exactly where we're jumping into the story. Those of you that have never read it, Tom Sawyer is quite a colorful character. He's a mastermind of philosophy. He likes to try to analyze humans and think of what their reaction is going to be to different things. And in some ways, he's a professional daydreamer. But he's pretty successful. And I'm going to read you the story because I think the premise of this class ought to be that a daydreaming student isn't hopeless. A daydreaming student might actually be one of your most valuable assets. Their brain is thinking. All you have to do is teach it to think for you, not against you. But their brain is thinking. It's a sad day when you ask a student, "What are you thinking?" And they say, "Nothing." It's a fun day when you say, "What are you thinking?" And they have this, "Well, which one do you want?" Like, they have this entourage of things that they could talk about. Okay, so here goes the story. We're going to have to read fast. Saturday morning was come, and all the summer world was bright and fresh and brimming with life. There was a song on every heart, and if the heart was young,
The music issued at the lips. There was a cheer in every face and a spring in every step. The locust trees were in bloom and the fragrance of the blossoms filled the air. Cardiff Hill, behind the village, and above it, was green with vegetation and lay just far enough away to seem a delectable land of delight, dreamy, reposeful, and inviting. Tom Sawyer appeared on the sidewalk with a bucket of whitewash and a long-handled brush, and he surveyed this fence. And all gladness left him, and a deep melancholy settled upon his spirit. 30 yards of board fence. 9 feet high, life to him seemed hollow, and existence was but a burden. With a sigh, he dipped his brush and passed it along the topmost plank. How many of you ever painted or whitewashed with a brush before? You know the motions. Your arm gets very tired after a while. He repeated this operation, did it again, and compared the insignificant whitewashed streak with the far-reaching continent of unwhitewashed fence. And then he sat down on the tree box, very discouraged. Soon his free friends would come tripping along in all sorts of delicious escapades, and they would make a world of fun of him for having to work, and the very thought of it burnt him like fire. He got out his worldly wealth and examined it. Bits of toys, some marbles and some trash, enough to buy an exchange of work maybe, but not half enough to buy as much as half an hour of pure freedom. So he returned his straitened means to his pocket and gave up the idea of trying to buy the boys. At this dark and hopeless moment, an inspiration burst upon him. Nothing less than a great, magnificent inspiration. Do you see what he did? He sat down and he daydreamed for just a bit. He wasn't lazy. He daydreamed. Now, if he would have sat there all day and daydreamed, that would be a very big problem. But his little burst of daydreaming there got him an idea. So he took up his brush and he went tranquilly to work. Imagine him, little boy, freckles, pants roll up, fishing pocket. Oh, I don't know what all's in his pockets. Ben Rogers hove into sight presently. The very boy of all boys whose ridicule Tom had been dreading. Ben's gait was a hop, skip, and a jump. Proof enough that his heart was light and his anticipations were high. He was eating an apple and he gave a long melodious whoop at intervals, followed by a deep-toned ding, dong, dong, ding, dong, dong, for he was personating a steamboat. As he drew near, he slackened speed, took the middle of the street, leaned far over to the starboard side, rounded to ponderously and with a laborious pomp and circumstance. For he was personating not only a steamboat, but the Big Missouri, and considered himself to be drawing 9 feet of water. He was the boat captain and engine bells combined, so he had to imagine himself standing on his own hurricane deck, giving the orders and executing them. Stop her, sir! Ting-a-ling-ling! The headway ran almost out, and he drew up slowly along the sidewalk. Ship up to back! Ting-a-ling-ling! His arms straightened out, stiffened at his sides. And I'm going to have to skip over some of this because it gets pretty long, but Mark Twain was so good at expressing how a boy might dramatize something in his own realm. So good. Read this to your students sometime. So I'm going to skip and I'm going to go all the way to the end. He says, stand by the stage now, let her go. Down with the engine, sir. Ting-a-ling-ling. Shh. And he does the little brakes, trying the gauge cocks. That was the name for them. Tom went on whitewashing. Serene. He paid no attention to the noises. Ben stared a moment and then he said, hey, you a stump, aren't you? No answer. He was whitewashing. Tom surveyed his last steps. I'm going to try. Maybe he did it something like this. Maybe he was whitewashing. He surveyed the last little bit of whatever he had done with the eye of an artist. And then he gave his brush another gentle sweep and surveyed the result as before. Ben ranged up alongside of him. Tom's mouth watered for the apple. But he stuck to his work. And finally Ben said, hey, old chap. You got work to do, don't you? Tom wheeled suddenly and said, why, it's you, Ben. I didn't notice you. Uh-huh. Say, I'm going swimming. I am. Don't you wish to come? And of course, now, you'd rather work, wouldn't you? Of course you would. Tom contemplated the boy a bit and said, depends what you call work. Huh. Why, ain't that work, Ben said. Tom resumed his whitewashing and answered carelessly, "Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. All I know is it suits me." "Oh, come on now. You don't mean to let on that you like this stuff." Tom continued to placidly brush the fence. That put the thing in a new light. Ben stopped nibbling his apple. Tom continued to paint daintily back and forth. He stepped back and looked at the effect, adding a touch here or there, criticizing each little knot hole. Ben watched every move, and finally, he was becoming interested and even absorbed. "You missed a spot there," he said. Finally, he said, "Tom, say, would you let me whitewash a little?" Tom considered, but he was about to say that it would be okay, but then altered his mind. No, I reckon it would hardly do," he said. "Ben, you see, Aunt Polly's awful particular about this fence, right here on this street. You know, if it was the back fence, maybe, but I don't think she'd like it. She's awful particular about this fence. It's got to be done very careful. I reckon there ain't but one boy in 1,000, maybe 2,000, that could do it the way it's got to be done." "Oh, come on, no. Just let me try, only just a little. Oh, I'd let you if you was me." "Ben, I'd like to. Honest, I would." Tom shook his head. "But Aunt Polly, well..." See, Jim wanted to, and if you know the characters of the story, this actually, he's inferring some a lot more than you will just catch on to, but that's okay. Jim wanted to, but she wouldn't let him. Sid wanted to, and she wouldn't let Sid. So, don't you see how I'm fixed? If you was to tackle this fence and anything was to happen to it, oh, come on, Tom, I'll be careful. Let me try. Say, I give you the core of my apple. No, Ben, now don't. I'm afeard. Just, I'll give you the whole apple. What's left?" Tom slowly gave him the brush. And with a look of reluctance on his face, but alacrity in his heart, sat down on the tree box. And while the late steamer, the Big Missouri, worked feverishly and sweated in the sun, the retired artist sat on the barrel in the shade close by, dangling his legs, munching on his apple, in planning the slaughter of more innocent boys. We're going to come back to that story a little later. Don't you see the mastery of such a daydreamer? Imagine if you could have a student with that much persuasion power. No, don't imagine. He'd probably persuade you to do stuff. But there's actually a lot of power there. There's actually a lot of intellect. And I think sometimes we teachers get the idea that if the student isn't working for us, then they're retarded or they're not in a good position. And sometimes it's actually the student isn't working for us because they don't think it's worth their time. And a student that's that good and they work against you can be a problem. At the end of the story, Mark Twain makes a statement. We're going to come to that a little later. But I have a statement that will match that. Listen to this. "Students will run and they'll sweat and they'll compete hard in a competitive game because they think it's fun. But give them some book lessons to do and the result is often blank looks and mangled eraser tips because they think it's work. And it's your job, it's my job, it's our job to make work look like painting a fence. How can we do this?" So, I'm going to stop now. I want three of you all, it can be anybody, I want three of you all just to say some of the things that disturbed you about daydreaming students. So give me a little time. What are some things that, questions that you had, problems that you wished you would have come across? We won't answer them now, we'll just want to get three of them. Does anyone care to say one of them?
Didn't you like about the wasted time of daydreaming? Is that what you're referring to, or are you talking about something else?
Talking about students that you know that they were daydreaming and you tried to help the problem and you couldn't get it there. You couldn't get them to be where you wanted them to be.
what's a practical way to get my students over the hump and be self-motivated instead of just driven by reminders and the constant rewards.
Okay.
Continue to keep them busy.
Okay. Thank you. Very good one. Self-motivation. I'm just going to shorten it to that. Okay, any more?
I had a student that would take all masters to do 10 questions and remind him that didn't work.
Okay.
He would look like he was studying, but he could write 2 in such a long time that it took 2 minutes.
Okay, so maybe we'll just go lack of speed. That's a very good one. Thank you. All right, another one?
Maybe daydreaming during class or watching another class but speaking to class.
Okay. We're going to put in and distracted in class, and it's your job to remember that this is in their class and possibly in someone else's class. Like they're distracted more than just in their own classes all the time. Thank you. All right, we're going to stop with that, and I know there's probably lots more, and if we would take the time, there's so many things we could discuss. So I want to jump into this. And then we have a little activity to do later. Daydreaming students. I've asked pretty many people, what would you do? So pretty many teachers that had taught, and I knew that they had dealt with daydreaming students. What are some things that you would do different now that you're looking back in hindsight with some daydreaming students? It's interesting. They didn't all say the same thing, but pretty muchly, they all gave the same idea. Here's the idea. A daydreaming student isn't the main problem. Someone who's daydreaming probably has a secondary problem, and their daydreaming, so to speak, is only a symptom of the something else. So, for example, maybe someone, it feels like you're constantly reminding them to work. Stick to your work. And you have to come back and you just kind of motor by their desk and you tap them on the shoulder and you say, please stick to your work. You might even set the timer and say, if you're not done with such and such by a certain time. And after a while you wonder, is it laziness? So the deeper problem actually ought to be discussed a little bit in this class. We don't have nearly enough time to go into all the reasons why someone might daydream. One of the things I actually asked Bing this morning, I asked him, I said, so what would you say is a problem why students like to daydream? And he said, well, I can think of maybe 2-3 reasons. I'm going to use, sorry, if Bing listens to this, he'll have to have him hear himself quoted. There's actually, he said, I think maybe 2, maybe 3 reasons. First one, they don't think the teacher is interesting or what the teacher is presenting is interesting. Think about that. Why did you daydream in school if you did? Wasn't it really difficult to pay attention if the teacher wasn't interesting? Second reason, there's something else more interesting than the teacher. Okay, so the teacher is interesting, but did you notice? The one snake in the tank is eating the other. Well, of course, there's hardly any teacher that can compare with that. Everyone would want to watch the snakes. Unless maybe the teacher was eating the snake. Then that would be more interesting. But you have to understand that it's not necessarily that they come to school with the idea, today I'm going to daydream. They're kind of just out for the biggest piece of pie, the most interesting thing available. And whatever it is, that's what they're going to do. And the third thing is, why they might daydream, he said at the very end, he said, it also could be a learning disability or learning difficulty. Some students, it's so difficult for them to separate their emotional lives, their home lives, from school, that if something traumatic is going on in their home life or their personal life, they can't work. They freeze up. They just lock up. And I think that's probably actually the most scary one for teachers. You might not know what all is going on.
And so suppose a student is facing something really emotionally traumatizing, and they come to school and they're thinking about this. They're thinking about this. They are still thinking about this. And the teacher says, if I have to come one more time and tell you to keep on working, you're going to be in trouble. No! But they literally cannot separate whatever they're supposed to separate. So I want to add a bit of caution. Please be careful, teachers. Don't stereotype your students. First week of school, you're a daydreamer, and I'm going to deal with you later. Give them a little chance. Be firm with them, but try to understand from their perspective. All right. Also, somewhere in this whole picture, I decided to take Bing's idea then and talk about teaching for a little bit. This, I just drummed these notes up this morning after I talked with him. If it's true that the students might not want to be observing their teacher during class because their teacher is not interesting enough, how can you be interesting? Well, I think that one of the things you should do is you should do more than just teach. You should do more than just, answer key. What did you think of when you started teaching? Those of you that haven't taught yet, when you get ready to start, do you think that the teacher is the person that holds the answer key, and it's the student's job to do the work, and all the teacher does is he has the answer key, and he kind of motors around, and he's the, you got that wrong, sorry, retry. And he'll come back around later and see if you did any better, but he's not going to do anything more than that. The ultimatum is to tell someone they got it wrong. Hopefully none of you did that. Hopefully none of you did. Hopefully most of you all were watching very carefully how your students related to life. Hopefully you were involved in their lives. Do you ask them about things that they did? Those of you, the younger students, isn't it so much fun to ask them, so what's going on with the kittens? Remember, the first year I taught third graders, and you find out more about their home lives than their parents will probably ever know. That might be kind of scary. Those of you with third graders, be careful. The teacher can find out a lot about you all. But when you do that, they open themselves up and it's so much more fun to be with them. And they enjoy being with you. Just show an interest in their life. So be more than just a teacher. I don't want to say be a buddy to them, but definitely be a friend to them. Someone that they can come and talk with about their own little problems. I'm going to give you all a little clue. I don't know if Joe is going to talk about this in his class with math. So hopefully, if you all see this demonstration and you get bored, I'm sorry. But here it goes. This is actually something that I learned from a curriculum called Math UC. You know, how many of you know of that curriculum, Math UC? I am impressed. I think it's actually something that all teachers with a special needs student in math would do well to investigate. Look it up online or ask me if you don't know where else to get it. But it's math. We'll go like this. Underneath the peppermint forest. This is how it's spelled. And it uses, hard word to say, manipulatives. A lot of them. So students that are kinesthetic or students that struggle with just seeing something or hearing about it, they can get their hands on it. It helps them. Here's something they taught was really, really neat. It's called the rule of four. Watch us do a division problem in fractions. Let's take 3/4 divided by 2/3. Okay? What's the hard part about doing a fraction set like this? There's probably more than one right answer, but someone give an answer. What's so hard about something like that?
Remembering which one to invert.
Remembering which one to flip. Okay? If you have a student that has dyslexia, it's a 50-50 chance whether they'll get it. And I actually changed that and I said, no, it's not a 50-50 chance. Because a student that has dyslexia is all sort of self-conscious about it. So if the back of their brain says it's probably this way, they automatically assume, I better say the other way because I'm usually wrong. And so if they think it's probably the second one, then they're going to say the first one. That's what they normally do. So anyway, the rule of four is really simple. You don't actually have to flip anything. All you have to do is create four new slots, four new numbers, and you just, following these arrows, I hate a whiteboard, I'm sorry, I was taught for a long time with a chalkboard. Follow those numbers and multiply. So someone help me out. If I follow this arrow, what will be my product?
12.
12. If I follow this arrow, what will be my product?
12.
And this one?
8.
And sorry for those of you that can't see, I'll move over. And this one?
9.
So now we actually have two new fractions. That's what we came up with. We're going to draw an equal sign. And the beauty of this is actually that the student doesn't even know what they're doing. They're just following step number 1, 2, and 3, and they can kind of envision where they're going after a bit. But pretty soon, they'll catch on to what's happening. Draw, this is your main sign here, division. Write your number. Write your numbers, and I'll step away so you can see this. Now you have 9 divided by 8 and 12 divided by 12. At first, the first few times you do this, you have to write it out. Now, I ran out of the end of my board there. You have to actually write it out like this. You have to write it out like that. 12 divided by 12 is 1, and leave the 9 divided by 8 on top. But then, here comes the really fun part. You can slide these, and this is, oh, I just love this. A lot of times these people that are struggling to learn, or they're daydreamers, if you want to give them that label, one of the reasons they don't pay close attention is because they're trying to make sense out of something that's just nuts and bolts. They love to piece it together with something larger. A motion, a sound, a noise, a flavor, a smell, something. So tell them that this thing, and I like to grab the two numbers, and slide them into another fraction. Slide them in. You might have to do it several times. So much fun to watch them later. They'll be at their desk and they'll be working, and all of a sudden their hand will come boiling up out from underneath their desk, and it'll... They know right away what they're doing. In their mind, they can see the numbers tumbling and all, like flipping into little slots. If you ever played a game of Tetris or something, this slides right in. So, here goes our new fraction. Well, I tried to describe it to you. Tell me what the new fraction would be. If you get it wrong, it's okay?
1 and 8.
Ah, okay, you gave the final answer. Can you give me the numerator over the denominator?
9 over 8.
There we go. Thank you. And you're done. Now, at this point, you could change it and make it in, you know, a proper fraction or whatever you wanted to do. But the simplistic design of having them do a rule of 4 looks probably pretty complicated for those of you that have never seen it. It'll catch on pretty quick. I've taught it to lots of students. The beauty of it is it'll work for a whole lot more than just division. It works for subtraction. You know those really nasty, gnarly, unlike denominator situations? This will work for that because it makes the denominators the same. It'll work for subtraction. So you have addition, subtraction, and division. And you can actually use the same rule for multiplication, but who wants to do that anyway? You can just go straight across and multiply straight across. It's called the rule of 4 because it works for all 4 order of operations. So fractions can be input into this and just come out. Anyway, I told Joe this. I don't know if Joe will bring up. He wrote this down on his notes too. Sometimes we teachers aren't satisfied if we teach a student a method about getting somewhere unless it's the best method. We want to strive for excellence, and that's good. Don't let that stop you. If you can teach them a safe, secure method of getting the answer, you'll boost their confidence much more than teaching them the most mathematical way to get to an answer. Some of my students never graduated beyond it. In the school of fractions, they never graduated beyond this. They were always stuck with the rule of 4. But you know what? They could get good grades then. Take them longer, and that's fine. They get good grades. And that's really, at the end of the day, that's what I cared most about. That they were secure, that they felt like they were learning, they were happy about school. By the way, some of you are probably wondering what's going on with this paperclip chain. Don't worry. It has to do with your behavior. So, it's up there. It has to do with your behavior. This is something I did to my students, and they were quite wadded till the end of the day. All right. The next thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is your expectations for your students. What do you expect your students to be like? The reason I'm going to talk a little bit about this is because we often have expectations very similar to what we were like in school. Your time in school frames a worldview for how you're going to treat your students, how you expect them to be. If you really struggled in school or school work period was hard for you, you will probably have more compassion for someone that is like-minded. If school was a breeze, if school wasn't hard, you'll think that, quit being stupid, you can get it. It was peanuts for me. It shouldn't take you 10 days to get this thing of fractions. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about expectations. I want to say, rather than expect excellence, expect diligence. Expect your students to work. They shouldn't sit there and daydream. Maybe we could say Tom Sawyer should not have sat on the tree box and did his little daydreaming. He did come up with a pretty interesting idea. But maybe he shouldn't have done that. Expect your students to work. Don't let, especially if you're coming into a new school, don't let their previous track record set the pattern for how this next school year is going to go. If you know that they always struggled with their behavior, it's probably what they're going to struggle with this year. Even if you were their teacher last year, give them a clean slate at the beginning of the year and keep your expectations where they can attain them. And I think you'll see growth. I was talking to myself a lot there. It's really easy to, I know it's so easy to get into this boxy cell, and all you can imagine out of your students is exactly what they were before. Keep your expectations where they can reach them. Don't be discouraged by their track record. Maintain high ideals for where your classroom can go and coach them. Be a coach for them, not a general. I asked Bing, what's one of your favorite ways to deal with a daydreamer? Before I give you his answer, because I thought it was pretty good, what do you all think is some good ways to deal with a daydreamer? Do we have any quick answers?
I find that you just have to get close to him.
Okay. So you just like kind of motor over beside his desk and you just kind of start working again. Wonderful. Anything else?
Catch their eye and give them a smile.
All right. So especially if they're looking around, you can kind of... Very good idea. Anything more? Okay, perfect. Do you have any examples for that, like a reward or something, or? Okay, very good. I hope to get into that a little bit more. She mentioned giving them a goal to work towards, and. There's some people that argue that you shouldn't give your students goals or rewards, and it's a good caution. But I'm going to stick my neck out and say that it's okay to do it if you do it in the right way. We'll come across that later, because I think it's real life. Imagine you being told, we are now no longer socialistic, we are communist. Everything you do is given into the pool of the general. Anything you make, money or profit, is for the general society. We'll give you a bed to sleep on, food to eat, clothes to wear. But beyond that, there's no hope of anything more. You would probably be very uninspired about producing anything more than the bare necessities. If you can inspire your students to see beyond the reward, you've been a true teacher. Sometimes it might take a few jump starts to get there. You can talk to me about that later. So be more than just a teacher, and give compliments. Please give compliments. Students love to be complimented, even if they haven't reached where you want them to go. Penmanship is one special way. If you're really hounding on penmanship, just a little word about, hey, thank you for keeping your slant the same, or For me, it was a lot of my girls had a back slant to their writing. Their writing would be slanted backwards, and I would just come around and say, hey, thank you, I can see that you're trying to straighten it out, maybe even lean it forward a bit. It's not that it's the way you always have to write, but just in my classroom, thank you for doing that. And they actually really loved it. They would thank me for thanking them. This is kind of special. All right. Maybe the next one, break up your routine enough that the people that would daydream are kind of shocked out of their reverie. I won't holler at you like we did yesterday, some of you were a little shocked. But break up your routine enough that they know that they had better keep up with you. If you are such a predictable teacher that they know, all right, came in from class, 10 minutes later, Miss Laurie's going to be outside the classroom filling his coffee mug, and that's our time to daydream. They'll do it. If they're tempted to daydream, they'll take that time. If you knew that every single time you came to one of these workshops, the teacher was going to give 10 minutes of meditation in silence, you would totally use that time to just relax and daydream. Totally. You might not even show up until the real thing starts. And that's what your students are going to do. By default, they're going to take all their opportunities that they can. Sorry, folks, we've got to take another one of these off. Anyway, we'll come back to that later. Do lots of examples in class. Your teachers are going to model you if they ever teach school. They'll either model you in a good way or model you in a bad way. They'll think of things like this. I want to do it like that. Or, I never want to do it like that. And you're one or the other. So do your best to make so that they will they'll want to be like you. All right, let's find out where we stopped here with Tom Sawyer. So remember, he has persuaded one boy to paint the fence for him. Where is he at? He is sitting there, dangling his legs. And the very last sentence, can anyone give the thought of what he was planning?
Slaughter of more innocents.
The slaughter of more innocents. I love that phrase. It's actually one of my favorite Mark Twain phrases, the slaughter of more innocents. Sounds so vicious. He was such a gory person. There was no lack of material either. Boys happened along every little while, and they came to laugh and to jeer. But you know what? They remained to whitewash the fence. By the time Ben was fagged out, Tom had traded the next chance to Billy Fisher for a kite in good repair. And when he played out, Johnny Miller brought in for a dead rat with a string to swing it on. And so on and so forth, hour after hour. And when the middle of the afternoon came, from being a poor, poverty-stricken fence painter, Tom was literally rolling in wealth. He had, beside the things before mentioned, 12 marbles, part of a Jew's harp, a piece of blue bottle glass to take a look through, a spool cannon, a key that wouldn't unlock anything, but it was neat. A fragment of chalk, a glass stopper of decanter, a tin soldier, a couple of tadpoles, 6 firecrackers, a kitten with only one eye, a brass doorknob, a dog collar, but no dog, the handle of a knife, 4 pieces of an orange peel, and a dilapidated old window sash. He had had such a nice, good, idle time the whole while. Plenty of company to talk to, and the fence had 3 coats of whitewash on it. If he hadn't run out of whitewash, he would have bankrupted every boy in the village. Tom said to himself that it was not such a hollow world after all. He had discovered the greatest law of human action, without knowing it, namely that in order to make a man or a boy covet a thing, it was only necessary to make that thing difficult to attain. If he had been a great and wise philosopher like the writer of this story, he would now have comprehended that. And here's his statement. Work consists of whatever a body is obliged to do, and play consists of whatever a body is not obliged to do. Think about that for a bit. It's pretty true. And this would help him to understand why constructing artificial flowers or performing on a treadmill is work, while rolling 10 pins or climbing Mont Blanc is only amusement. There are wealthy gentlemen in England who drive 4-horse passenger coaches 20 or 30 miles on a daily line in the summer because the privilege costs them considerable money. But if they were offered wages for that service, they would turn it into work and then they would resign. So we'll stop. Students are going to take what you give them at its face value. If you give them work, it's going to be work. If you give them something enjoyable, albeit it's still the same work, it'll be enjoyable. It's your job to kind of take the tools there and turn it into something. I'm going to ask you now for some more of those questions. We have some of these. I'm going to ask you now for some more questions, but I'm not going to write them down. Do we have any courageous souls with some quick questions? Things that you dealt with Daydreamer students, wishing you would have got answers for.
How can I get a student to connect his daydreaming problem to the homework he takes home every evening?
Okay. Thank you. In the description that I had a little note at the very end that sometimes I'll take home a stack of homework, and that's a typical problem. Okay? I want to just air these questions, so thank you so much for that. Let's get any more. Is there any more questions?
How do you challenge a student who is IQ level 2 grades ahead of himself so he doesn't have to work hard to get his work done?
Ooh. That is tough. So he can finish his work and then daydream.
There's no push because it's not hard.
Thank you. Very, very good question. All right, any more?
I had a student that he hated homework, and he would daydream, and at the end of the day, at least, this is serious. And he was just crammed through it, and he could often eliminate that homework because his dad was not supportive of that much homework. And we go to talk to him about it and say, look, like, you got to perform a little better. He'd dissolve into tears because he knew it was a big deal.
Wow. So a little bit picking into that thing about the dad. You're saying the dad didn't support lots of homework coming home.
Well, he was trying to help him get his work done. And so there was home incentives of, getting work done at school. So he was trying to back me.
Oh, I see. Very good. Thank you. Just to clear that up. So the dad was there to support you. And he. Okay, wonderful. Okay? Very good. Thank you. I hope that we can come back to some of these. I'm trying to remember your faces with your questions. So let's get one more question quick.
Yeah, my struggle has mostly been with students that are actually students who are overthinkers. They go through their work, and it just takes so long that they have to think through every angle of the question. And then they eventually get distracted. It's not so much that they're sitting there staring at the... Well, they do sit there and stare at the ceiling, too, but... because they try to figure the problem out so thoroughly, their thoughts get distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And their work just ends up being so slow.
Mm-hmm. That is definitely a problem. But they're thinking. You're saying they're still thinking. It's not like they're just void of thoughts.
Right, right.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. Is that the first bell or is that their second one? First bell. First. I hope we have a little bit more time. Thank you for those thoughts. I'm going to give you three. I'm going to call these my three favorite methods of dealing with a daydreamer. Three favorite methods. And your questions were wonderful, but I want to briefly see if these three will help at all. First one. You don't even have to talk to them about their problem. Just talk to them. Because if you talk to them, it establishes a connection and they feel that you are concerned about them. If all you do is make a mental note that so-and-so was daydreaming today, they'll never know that you noticed. So just talk to them. Maybe you can just ask them how they're doing in their work. And it makes that little bit of connection. Ivan Martin's talks are so key to this. When you make that first connection, they realize that you care about them. All right, number two. Be consistent. And this one is, don't let them daydream for 3 months and then all of a sudden say, all right,
you have a problem with daydreaming, you do this twice more, you're going to have to stand at lunch recess the whole recess. It's kind of radical, I know, but you put your own situation in there. Don't just pounce on them. Some teachers have this method of discipline that's kind of like the find and the pounce method. Find a problem and they pounce on it. And the students actually get this trembly feeling that the teacher is out to find their problems and then destroy them. So talk with them and then be consistent. If they have a problem that's fairly little, work on it. I love the idea of going over and standing beside their desk. Just kind of, that's the only thing you have to do. Just talk to them. Go over and be beside their desk. The third thing. Communicate, can you guess what I'm going to say, with?
Parents.
Parents, absolutely. Your parents are your biggest asset in this situation. They know what's going on at home. They've actually raised this child, and you haven't. Obviously, if the child is a foster child or something, that might be a kind of a working together issue. But talk with those parents. Keep up to date with them. I wish that if I could go back and redo some of mine, I would have done that more. Talk with them. All right. Well, it's time for the end of class. By the way, those things right there, if we had more time, we would talk about those questions that we had and try to discuss if that would help. But I'm pretty certain I already know it would help because I tried it, and it does. So if that's any blessing to you, go for it. We didn't have all our paper clips taken away from our long line. And by the way, this is one of the things that I have used as kind of a reward thing. If my students knew that there was a behavior thing that I was watching, I might would just say, hey, there's a slight problem in our classroom. I'll tell you all at lunchtime, but until then, I'm just going to, whenever I see it occurring, I'm going to take away a paper clip. Okay? It's that moment of unknown. You need to give them a line when they'll know. Shouldn't forever hold them in suspense. They get really wadded, especially conscientious students. But it does something good for them to know that you're doing something and they don't know why. There's a lot of problems that can get cleaned up in that little bit of time. A lot of problems. Anyway, I would love to have you all guess what it is. But anyway, what this was is every time I looked up and saw one of you all looking away for more than the count of three, I took away a paper clip. That's what the rule was. Eyes on me. We're having class. All right, I would like to sing our song today as a closing thing. I know it's going to go over time. I don't have a song to thank you for. This song is one that my students and I really, really enjoyed singing. And I hope that if you want, you can take this copy home with you. If you've ever heard of the quartet Narrow Way, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of them. They sing this version. It's very, very similar to this. So we're going to sing this quick, and then I'll dismiss you all. You know what? We're just going to try to jump right into parts. Starts on a weird chord. Here goes. Do, mi, fa, tenor, do. Father God, just for today, help me to walk.
Help me to walk your narrow way.
the end of class. Thank you all for coming.